In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred and Little Stevens Underground Garage, and it's time once more for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest is Adam Wiener, also known as Low Cut Connie. He's the group's piano-playing frontman and lead singer. Now, their album from last year, Art Dealers, is home to the track, Are You Gonna Run?, which our very own Stevie Van Zandt took an interest in, and with Adam's approval, remixed the song, adding in himself on guitar and backing vocals. The new version of the tune is the recent coolest song in the world, and we'll take a listen to a bit of it now, followed by my interview with Adam on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens' Underground Garage.
Chips are down, will you lay it on the line? Or are you gonna run? Are you gonna run from the baby? If the words don't come, you take a little time. Or are you gonna run? Are you gonna run?
This is the Mighty Manfred, and with me today for our coolest conversations is Adam Wiener, better known as his alter ego Low Cut Connie. He's the frontman, singer, songwriter, and pianist. The most recent album is last year's Art Dealers, and that features the track Are You Gonna Run, which our very own Stevie Van Zandt took an interest in. He's remixed, added guitar and vocal parts to it, making it this week's coolest song in the world. Hey Adam, how are you?
What's up, Manfred? What a pleasure and an honor to be here with you.
Well, it's a two-way highway, my friend. Two-way highway. Travel on it now. Now, I know the band is based in Philadelphia, and I heard you're from New Jersey originally. Is that right? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in South Jersey, just like 20 minutes outside of Philly. So, Jersey guy.
Right. Okay. So, you know, Palmyra Delran is a Jersey lady.
I do. You know, it's so funny because, like, Palmyra and Delran are towns that I played soccer in when I was like 8 years old. And it's like two towns over from where I grew up. So it's amazing to hear the name of that group and her, listen to her show and just hear Palmyra Delran all the time because I used to hang out there when I was eight.
Oh, so you at a youngster, you were playing playing soccer there. Around that time, you began to have interest in music?
Oh, yeah. From the time I was born, I always gravitated to music. But you remember that movie Amadeus about Mozart?
Oh, not too, just too many notes, take a few out. Yes, I do.
And you remember when Mozart plays the piano, or was it the harpsichord, and then they flip him over on his back and he does the same thing on his back? So I was like 4 years old when that came out, and I saw that and I said, I want to be able to do that. So I taught myself how to play like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star or something like that, and then I concentrated on learning it upside down, and I figured it out, and my parents were like freaked out by that, and they said, I guess he's gonna play piano, you know.
Well, let me ask you about your folks. So was there like a lot of music in the household? Did your parents play instruments?
My parents are not musical, but they love to dance. So they played a lot of music that you can dance to. Everything 60s, Motown, Otis Redding, a little bit of British Invasion, but they just love to dance and they're excellent dancers. Both my parents are incredibly great on the dance floor. And we had a DJ here in Philadelphia who was a dear friend of mine, Jerry Blavitt, the Geeter with the Heater, and he played old school dance music all the time, and that's the music that I grew up with.
What are you calling old school dance music?
50s, 60s,
Okay,
you
yeah.
know, 2 minute and a half records that you could dance to. That's what my parents listened to, and that's what they sort of injected into my bloodstream.
Do you have any siblings?
I do. I have an older brother. He's a physician. So, you know, my parents got a doctor and they got a recalcitrant, irresponsible rock star, you know.
So I was about to say, so they got the doctor, so that kind of frees you up to be the music guy.
I grew up in a Jewish family and they got their doctor, and so they kind of laid off with me and they were like, whatever you're gonna do, you're gonna do, you know.
Was going to ask you if there was like a defining moment for you growing up music wise, but I guess it was Amadeus being flipped over on his back.
Well, that was the first. But then when
Okay.
I was 5 years old, the summer of 1985, there were two records that came out that changed my life and that turned me on to music and performing. And the first was Purple Rain by Prince. I was absolutely hypnotized by the When Doves Cry video.
Yeah.
And it's an earth-shattering moment for me watching that video. And the second is, of course, Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, which my family loved that record. And I remember all those videos, Dancing in the Dark and everything. And that summer, you know, Purple Rain and Born in the USA were one and two in the country, and they kept trading spots, right?
Yeah.
And I just remember being absolutely, from the top of my head to the bottom of my toes, turned on by both those artists. And it's funny to think about so many decades later. I kind of think that it got in my bloodstream in a way. And a lot of the music that I make is sort of a combination of Prince and Bruce Springsteen in a way, and their influence on me.
So that was when you were five.
Yeah, I was 5 years old.
Okay. And so when was it that you started playing piano?
Just around then, you know, I saw that movie Back to the Future, and I saw the way that he played guitar when he played Chuck Berry,
Yeah.
and we didn't have a guitar in the house, so I started banging around on the piano trying to play Chuck Berry songs, and then later I got into the Rolling Stones and I tried to translate the Rolling Stones songs onto the piano. I wanted to play piano like Keith Richards played guitar, you
Well,
know.
so you were teaching yourself how to play piano, or did you take lessons at some point?
I took lessons, but I wasn't very good. I have a sort of a mental block with reading. Reading music is just never came naturally to me, and
Yeah.
I just never progressed. But then the piano teacher would leave, and then I'd turn the radio on and I could play along with all the music I heard on the radio. And pretty much any song I heard, I could pretty immediately play on the piano. But then she'd put music in front of me, sheet music, and I couldn't play it. They sort of figured out that I wasn't going to learn in a conventional manner, and
Yeah.
they realized that I should be left to my own devices to teach myself.
So you're playing keyboards. Did you play with anybody or in bands in high school?
Yes, I had a couple bands in high school. I was in a band called the Gherkins. What a wonderful name for a band.
That is.
You
Yeah.
wonder, you
Did you ever get
wonder.
pickled?
Yeah, you wonder why some of these bands don't succeed when you hear the names. You know, I did battle the bands and everything. But Manfred, I wasn't the singer at first. I was the keyboard player. There was another kid in school who sang better than me. Or people thought he sang better than me. So I was the piano player. And then he graduated, and I sort of had to become the singer by default.
Yeah.
And we got up on stage at this Battle of the Bands thing, and I was shy. I was very shy in school. I was very introverted and kept to myself. But when I got on stage at this Battle of the Bands thing, something came over me and I yelled into the microphone, "If you scream loud enough, I will take my shirt off." And sure enough, they did, and I did. And it was like something had taken over my body, like the Incredible Hulk, you know. And this stage confidence came over me that I didn't have the rest of the time.
You know, I watched, what was this, the documentary about, it's not Tom Jones, but another one of those guys. Oh, man, I'm sorry, I can't think of his name offhand. Mm-hmm. But he was on Time Magazine a couple of times, but give me one of his names. Not Tom Jones, but...
Engelbert Humperdinck.
That's it. And he has a whole thing about offstage being very shy and sedate. And then, but when he walks onto the stage, then he's, you know, this other part of his personality emerges that normally isn't there, but he comes onto the stage and that just sort of, that's where he believes, you know, if he could stay there all the time, he'd be there all the time. But it's just a thing that exists when he's in that moment of taking command of a stage.
That's me. I mean, I am fairly shy in my daily life, but I'm completely, completely fearless when I'm on stage. Nothing bothers me. No inhibitions. I see videos of myself doing things on stage and I can't even believe it, you know. But, you know, Elvis was shy. Prince was shy. A lot of David Bowie was like kind of shy, you know, like some of these people are kind of quiet in a way. And then they get on stage and it's another story.
So you're playing the Gherkins. Was that still the Gherkins when you were taking on the lead vocal choice?
Yes.
Okay. So you're doing that in high school. And I'm assuming in this period of time, you've already decided I want to be making music. Is that fair to say?
No, actually, I thought I was going to be an actor or a dancer. And I went to New York City.
Well, wait a minute, the acting thing, where does that come along? I mean, that's developing alongside you're playing music. Yeah.
Oh, yes. I was.
So in high school, you were like in whatever the drama club or what is it called? The drama.
Yes. The thespians.
Thespians. Oh,
and I starred in cabaret as the MC and, you know, all
that's cool
plays. And I just loved being on stage. I felt very natural performing. I thought that my path was going to be as an actor. I also loved to dance. So I went to this thing called Experimental Theater Wing in New York City, 1998, 1999. And I spent a year in this experimental theater group where people, you know, we all run around naked, pouring candle wax on each other and screaming and getting in touch with our inner primal instincts and stuff, you know. And that was cool. That was cool. But after doing that for a year, I had this job. I had gotten a job playing piano in a restaurant. And that led to other jobs playing piano in other bars and restaurants.
All right. Well, let me interrupt because there's this whole thing about I read something. You were playing piano in gay bars and karaoke bars, restaurants, ballet classes.
Yes.
Is this the time of Lady Fingers?
Almost, because at this time I wasn't 21 yet, so I could only work in certain kinds of places playing piano.
And what would you play?
Anything. This is like the tip bucket fishbowl era of my life. So if somebody wanted to hear Barry Manilow, I'm playing Barry Manilow. But
you got to know the Barry Manilow.
Yes, but like I said, if I've heard a song, I can figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, it's just been a thing I've been able to do since I was a kid. And so my job was playing piano and I'm spending all day doing this experimental theater stuff. And eventually I just kind of figured out that I wanted to play my own music and I wanted to try to integrate this fearless performing style into the musical side.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really turned on by performing other people's dialogue. And that was a real tip off. You want to be an actor, you have to be prepared to spend your life performing other people's material, right?
Right, right.
And also waiting for somebody to call you and give you a job and a part, you know? And I just wanted to burn and just play music every night and play in every club and bar and restaurant I could find. And that's kind of what I did. And when I was 20, when I turned 21 that first week, I got my first kind of steady 2-3 night a week job in a bar, which was this gay karaoke bar called Pegasus at 59th and Lexington in New York. And changed my life. It was an amazing gig. I would accompany the drag performers.
Yeah.
So I'm playing Diana Ross for the Diana Ross performer, or Tina Turner for the Tina Turner person. And they liked country music, actually, in that bar, because there was kind of like a gay cowboy sub scene in that club. So I could play Elvis and I could play Johnny Cash and that kind of stuff. They liked that. And they also liked my songs. I start to play my own music.
So when did you start writing your own songs?
I've always been writing songs. I haven't always been writing good songs, but I remember, I think I was 8 or 9, and I wrote a nice piano melody, and I came up with the words, "Lover, discover me," which isn't good, but it's not terrible, especially for 8 years old, you know?
That's great, yeah.
I wrote these very sad, romantic, heartbreak songs at age 8, 9, 10. God knows where that came from. But I was always good, Manfred. I was good with the music, and I just like live and breathe melodies and chord progressions and rhythm. It took me a while to catch up with the words, you know? And so when I was around 21, 22, I start playing in those Pegasus, and I'm playing for 4 hours a night. I got better with the words because I learned a little bit about what words work, you know, for an audience.
Yeah.
What lyrics, how they function, and which ones I felt connected to and which ones I didn't.
And so when did you adopt this name of stage persona, or name of Lady Fingers?
Right around then. I think I was 24 or 25.
Yeah.
I wrote a song called Lady Fingers that was based on the fact that one of the guys in this bar was complimenting me that I was the best piano player that they had in the bar, and he called me Lady Fingers. Like I had such a gentle, beautiful touch on the piano.
Yes.
And I wrote a song. It was called Licking My Lady Fingers. And a friend of mine heard me play this song, and she said to me, "That's your name. That's you. Your Lady Fingers."
Oh.
Yeah.
So you're doing, you said, like 2-3 nights a week, really putting yourself out there to play all the time. Were you able to support yourself with music at this time?
Not particularly. I actually took I had a series of awful day jobs. My music was at night, but during the day, I was a secretary in a doctor's office. I did phone banking. I tuned pianos. I worked in a music store. I worked in a clothing store. I was a teacher. I was a tutor for SATs. I did all kinds of stuff.
When you say a teacher, were you a substitute teacher, or were you teaching like a class for a whole school term?
Initially, I taught summer school for a private school. The kids that just like got kicked out or didn't make it, and they would say, "Here,
oh, the cool kids."
Yeah, exactly. Go and teach this kid. This kid just got out of juvie hall, and he needs 3 credits of English this summer to graduate. Go teach him English for 3 weeks, and so he can graduate. So I did
that sounds kind of challenging.
Yeah, and so that was interesting, and that led to a lot of other teaching gigs. And I ended up working for a company that matched me with homeschool students. which in some cases were very wealthy New York families that wanted to homeschool their kids. And in other cases were scholarship kids, typically Black and Latino kids who were very smart and needed extra, you know, tutoring at home.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on a Monday, I would be teaching on the Upper East Side in like a penthouse. And then on Tuesday, I'd be going to like 205th Street in the Bronx to tutor some kid at home. And I actually really enjoyed that part of my life because I got to meet a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I really liked teaching, actually. It's something I miss doing.
Well, so my understanding is that if you were set up for some sort of teaching job, and then the summer before that happens is when Low-Cut Connie formed. And it formed, I think, as a side project.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you've told the story a lot of times, but for the sake of our people that are tuning in here to you for the first time, finding out about you for the first time in the Underground Garage, do you mind explaining how you guys formed?
Yeah, I mean, I turned 30 years old. And at this point, my music career, although I was gigging and playing all these kinds of gigs and traveling with it too, I was making no money. I had no fans. And at this point, it was kind of like the time to accept that this was a hobby and it was never going to happen for me. You know, I did it. I tried. I did a decade, but it just didn't happen. And I got offered a full-time salaried teaching gig in New York at a really good company, and I took it. And so I had this summer prior to starting this teaching gig to, you know, sow a couple last wild oats, if you will, you know?
Yeah.
And I had a friend from England who was also a teacher and a musician, Danny. And
what
I
was Danny's last name?
Finnemore.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I had a friend in Florida, Neil Duncan, who was also teaching middle school in Gainesville, Florida, and was a musician. And these are friends of mine, and we're all, you know, around 30 years old. And
well, how did you meet these guys? So they're both teachers. Was this through the teaching network that, I mean, the companies that you were working for? Or?
I met Danny at the Lakeside Lounge in New York City. Okay. When Ladyfingers was playing a residency there in the summer of 2005 or six. And he was visiting New York City with his band, and he saw my band, and we became friends one debauched evening in the Lakeside Lounge. And then
hell yeah.
And then my friend Neil had lived in New York City, and he was trying to be an audio engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I became good friends. I started giving him piano lessons.
Oh.
And we started recording music together. And then, like me, he said, you know, I need to leave New York. I can't afford it. And I'm going to take this teaching job in Florida. And so all three of us were facing adulthood a little bit late, but we were ready to, you know, transition into adulthood. And I said, why don't we get together and just for a weekend and just make one little EP?
So this was your suggestion?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And so I invited Danny over from England. I said, we'll go to Florida to my buddy Neil's house. He's got a little rinky-dinky studio in his garage. And we'll record a couple of my songs, a couple of your songs. And it'll be fun, and it'll be the last thing we do before I take this job, you know. So we went to Florida. It was like a week where every day was like 104 degrees, and we're in this garage.
104 degrees and 100% humidity.
Yeah, and there's no air conditioning in this garage, and there's no windows. And we're in there trying to record, and I remember the guys saying, I think I can make it through this 3-minute song before I pass out. Let's just play it fast. And then the second it's over, we'll open the door and we'll run outside and breathe.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that song was a song called Rio that ended up changing my whole life. And we ended up recording 11 songs in 3 days. And that those 11 songs became the first Low Cut Connie album.
Okay.
And I can't stress enough that this was a total unplanned pregnancy. This was like nobody intended to start a new band. Nobody intended to put out records and try to have a career. It was 100% for fun.
So it's 100% for fun, but still you finished the recording session and you decided we're going to put this out as a CD.
I went back
or LP. I mean, I think a CD, right?
Yeah, in 2011, that's what people were doing. This is right before streaming. And I printed up a bunch of CDs. I start giving them away to friends of mine. And people say to me, this is the best shit that you've ever done. This is amazing. This is the best rock and roll we've heard in years. And I was saying, really? Really? These are like the fuck around songs. These are like the runts of the litter, the little reject songs. Because I was recording all the songs that people in the music business had told me were too weird. Right?
Yeah.
So songs like Big Thighs, New Jersey, and Shit, Shower, and Shave, and Rio. All of these songs that people had told me, they're just too weird. Like, nobody's ever going to want to sign you or play you on the radio. They're too weird. Those are the songs that I'm sitting here, you know, 14 years later, still playing every night of my life, you know. So we start giving these CDs away. And Manfred, do you know this guy in New York named Robert Christgau?
No.
He's a music critic. He was at the Village Voice for 30 or 40 years. And I sent him a CD. I used to always send him my Ladyfingers CDs.
Right.
And he ends up reviewing the Get Out the Lotion album, and he gave it a smash glowing review. He said it was one of the best albums of the year. And he passed along the CD to somebody at Rolling Stone magazine.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then they reviewed it with a glowing review. And at this point, we hadn't toured. We hadn't done more than 3 gigs. We didn't even live in the same country. You know? So we're in Rolling Stone magazine, and it became this like critics thing. The next thing you know, it's in Maxim and Billboard, and the New York Times did a little write-up on it, and Guitar World and USA Today. And all of a sudden, it's like this buzzy thing. Have you heard this record? And the kind of coup of the whole thing was on NPR. There's a show called Fresh Air with Terry Gross.
Right.
And at the time, they had like 2 million listeners a day. And Fresh Air with Terry Gross did a 7-minute review of the album. And they actually ran it twice. So millions of people heard this review of this album. And we weren't really a band. I mean, we didn't have a picture of ourselves on the internet. I mean, it was sort of a mysterious thing. And I am selling hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of CDs a day.
Right. So when that, as it starts to, it's getting all this exposure.
Yes.
Who is contacting you and asking for copies of the CD? Where, I mean, you were doing a mail order thing, or how are
yes,
you?
I set up a PayPal thing. I purchased lowcutconnie.com, thank God. And I made this little PayPal thing, which would go to my personal email, and I'd come home from school and I would sit there packaging hundreds of CDs and going to the post office.
And nobody helping you with that?
Yeah, I had a little help.
Okay.
from my family.
Okay.
It got into
so thousands. Your parents were like, oh my God, he's finally doing something. He's making some money.
Yes. It ended up being thousands of CDs. And then I had kind of a gut check moment, because now I'm 31 years old. I'm teaching. And I'm thinking.
Oh, so you did take the teaching job.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. In fact, I continued to teach for another few years.
Yeah.
I knew, Manfred, I knew this was my shot. This is it.
Yeah.
Like, I just went through the whole process of getting out, but now the universe is pulling me back in. You know, I suddenly have fans.
Okay, so it's blowing up and you're sending out the CDs, and you had mentioned, you know, you guys hadn't played any shows. Your two buddies that you began the collaboration with, were they on board with performing as Slow Cut Connie? Were they on board with exploring what you were doing, or were they like, I think it seems like one of the two guys stuck with you for a while, and the other guy was like, nah. What happened?
So one guy stuck with it for a year.
Okay.
We actually made a second album together, Call Me Sylvia, which has our song Boozophilia on it, which became a signature song of ours for a lot of reasons, but mostly because President Obama put it on his first Spotify playlist a few years later. So, you know, he stuck it out for a year, and then he and his wife had a baby, and he was out, which I think was the absolute correct decision. And the British guy came to the U.S. for a little bit, and we gave it a good shot. And then he decided he wanted to go back to England. He fell in love over there. He took his teaching job back, and we did a long distance relationship. But as the band grew and grew and grew, it became impossible. So,
are you still in contact with these guys?
I am. Yeah.
Great.
And you know, so after the first couple years, as of, I guess, 8 years ago, you know, I was the guy.
Yeah.
And I had to sit there and say, well, what now? And I decided, Manfred, that I had gotten on the map with my records.
Yeah.
But what I really, really wanted to do was put together the best live rock and roll show in the world. That's what I wanted to do. Because remember, my background was performing on stage.
Right.
And I kicked the door in a little bit with my recordings from those first two albums, but nobody had really seen us live much. We never had the ability to tour very much. And then I pivoted and I said, this is going to be a band that plays 80 shows a year, and we are going to be the best rock and roll show that you could see. And that took a couple years to kind of build. But then we totally switched it around and we became known as the live band, you know, which my reputation for the last 8 years has been for what we do live on stage.
Well, let me ask you, but let's digress to this for a moment, because I always feel like you put on a killer live show, then it becomes this thing where, oh, you know, the recordings are okay, they're fine, you know, but you got to go see them live. That's the thing. It seems like it's almost a double-edged thing. It's like, well, those are two different mediums. You know, if you're sitting passively listening to something, you know, then when I'm making music and bands and stuff and try and put stuff in there that, you know, with the ear candy, whatever, that there's something extra to that. And then the live performance, I mean, I'm going to be sweating on top of you, you know.
I want to kill with both, you know.
My frustration is that people see you, if you have a killer live thing, then you're running the risk of them being dismissive of recording in your recordings, because no, this is what they are. It's like, no, as you said, you know, it's both of it, man, you know.
I think you're right. But again, I was modeled in a way, inspired by what I saw when I was a child.
Yeah.
Which, remember, I referenced Purple Rain and Born in the USA.
Right.
I was modeled off of these artists who were monsters in the studio, who wrote monster songs and made monster records and were monsters on stage, right? You talk about somebody like Prince. He was a genius in the studio and he was a genius on stage, you know? And I aspired to be both things. I wanted to excel writing songs, recording songs, and I wanted to excel on stage. What that has created is that I think by this point, you know, over a decade into the band, I have fans who got into Low Cut Connie because of our records, especially our older fans.
Right.
And then I have fans that follow us on tour and go see us, you know, 10 shows in a row and fly all over the country and all over the world to see us because our live shows, you know, give them something that is transformative. I think they like our records, but they really like our shows. I try to give people and kill people both ways.
Yeah. Well, right. Okay. So you mentioned Barack Obama putting you on a list. There's what's it, a Spotify list? What was it?
Yeah, it was
okay.
His
so there's
first
that, and
Spotify
and
list.
Then you got some other celebrity endorsements there. Elton John, is it Sir Elton John? Anyway, yeah. he's name dropped you guys. You appeared on Late Night with Seth Meyers back in like 2018. Have you done any other like television shows since then?
Well, during a pandemic, we did Colbert when he was okay. When he was in his basement, we performed my song called Help Me when we were in quarantine. We had to film it, and then they aired it remote, you know?
Yeah.
And we've done a ton of morning, you know, all the good morning shows. Good Morning Ottawa, Good Morning Louisville, Good Morning Philly, you know.
There's so many good mornings all across the world, I imagine. But all across the nation, yeah, and Canada.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so.
But, you know, speaking of SiriusXM, which has, I have to give a special shout out that I've had this 10-year plus relationship with Sirius because Dave Marsh was the first person to interview me on the radio. And that was on his show on SiriusXM back in 2011, right when the album first came out. And, you know, eventually Howard Stern asked us to do a song for his David Bowie tribute back in 2018.
Yeah.
And then I got to go on the wrap-up show and come up to Sirius and do that. And he spoke about us on Stern Channel. So I've then the underground Garage and the Outlaw Country. It's been an amazing SiriusXM has been an amazing supporter of Low Cut Connie over the years, so that's part of the story too.
Well, we're going to tie into the Underground Garage bit here with Mr. Van Zandt's attention. So the most recent album is Art Dealers, came out last year, right? Came out last year.
Yes.
Okay, and the track on there, Are You Gonna Run, comes to Stevie's attention. Do you know how he caught wind of it, or has he been listening to you guys all along? Have you been in communication with him? How does he single on that cut?
Well, we've known each other for years, and he had asked me to perform at his book launch event,
mm-hmm.
2021. And so that was an event with him and Bruce and Steve Buscemi and Jon Stewart. And they needed a musician to perform because they were all just reading from his book and talking. So I did that. And then I interviewed Stevie on my show. And I think
when you say your show, this is the what I was going to have the Tough Cookies thing.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I'll ask you about that in a minute. Okay. So you interviewed him on that.
Yeah. And I think my understanding is that he was always aware of Low Cut Connie and a fan, but was looking for that one song to collaborate on. And that was like a fastball down the middle of the plate for Underground Garage. And when he heard Are You Gonna Run, he said, that's the one.
And so he got in touch with you himself? Or through surrogates or
through Wicked Cool, which is his fantastic label. They let me know that he was working on it and stand by. It took a while.
Yeah.
But when I heard what he did to it, because you never know, you know, you never know what's going to happen when you take a song and you remix it or you add something to it.
Yeah.
You kind of wait and brace yourself that you're not going to like it.
that you're not gonna like it. So let's back up here. You find out he's interested, so there's got to be some elation there, I would assume. But so what is your initial reaction?
Well, I was thrilled.
Okay.
That we finally found a song that he felt like really was right in his wheelhouse and right in the wheelhouse of the underground garage format, because it's really one of the weird things about Low Cut Connie is we sit between radio formats.
Yeah.
Like, we get played on Sirius on Outlaw Country quite a bit, but I don't think anybody would accuse us of being a country band, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And on terrestrial radio, you know, we're a little too old school for indie and modern rock or top 40, but we're a little too edgy for classic or the Americana side, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So we sort of fall between the cracks, which, as annoying as that is professionally, it's a point of pride artistically, because, you know, you should always do things that you feel is artistically what you want to do, you know, make the best, weirdest, coolest music that you can make. And if it doesn't fit in a format, it doesn't fit in a format. I just like the fact that Stevie felt like this song really fit.
And so, you know, he's working on it, and Wicked Cool tells you he's working on this thing, and we'll let you know what he comes up with. Or did you have any input to what he was doing?
I got to hear it. Oh, I definitely had input. I got to hear the initial version.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went up to New York and worked with his man, Jeff, who's a fantastic engineer. And the three of us.
Sanoff, right? Jeff Sanoff?
Yes, fantastic. Yeah. And me, Jeff, and Stevie went around a couple rounds and mixed it together.
Well, very cool. So your final reaction then?
I think it's a smash. I think he hit it out of the park. I was bracing myself. You never know. Because, you know, listen, Manfred, if Paul McCartney called me tomorrow and said, hey, man, I'm going to do a remix of your song, I'd be thrilled. But I'd also have to prepare myself. What if he does something that's not great? You know, Stevie nailed it. Capital N, nailed. It is a smash. I could not be happier with how this turned out.
Way cool. So, let's say, you know, like, you mentioned Paul McCartney. Are there any other people that you would love to dig in contact with you and say, hey, let's revisit one of your tunes here and remix one of your tunes? Is there anybody else on the short list?
So many, but Keith Richards is like one of my greatest musical heroes. I just think everything he touches has soul and feels great. So that would be a dream call, you know.
Who's somebody that's like really big, and but you would be like, I don't know, you know, let's, you know, that you might have a lot of apprehension.
I don't know, but I will tell you that 2 years ago, I got to meet one of my ultimate songwriting heroes. I mean, I think top three songwriters in history, which is Smokey Robinson. I got to meet Smokey, and that was incredible. And I thought to myself, damn, if there's one artist in this world that I would like to collaborate on anything, sing together, write together, play piano for, whatever, that would be Smokey.
Well, you put it out there in the universe right now. The universe is listening.
Yeah, because he sounds great. He's still writing good songs. He put a record out last year called Gasms. So he's still out there doing his thing.
Yeah. Okay, you know, here's something. Here's a quote I found. You did this interview, I think it was last year, with Jill Riley, and is, my job is to make people feel free to lose their inhibitions. And I was wondering, did you see that Little Richard documentary from last year called I Am Everything?
I sure did. In fact, the filmmakers consulted with me. I'm thanked in the film because I wrote an article about Richard called Pour on the Steam. That's about when Little Richard, before he called himself Little Richard, And he was working in a drag setting.
Yeah.
His day job, or I should say his other job, was he was a dishwasher in a bus, in a Greyhound bus station.
Yeah.
And I wrote an article about Richard's time as a dishwasher and his transformation into becoming Little Richard during that time. And they referenced my article in the film. So I thought the film was fantastic. I thought they really did a good job of capturing the magic of Richard.
I did as well. But this whole notion of making people feel free to lose their inhibitions, I mean, he is all about that. But then the documentary, the tragedy is that he was never truly free, right? He was could be outrageous, certainly, but he was never seen to be wholly free within his own skin.
That's right.
Right. And so you say my job is to make people feel free to lose their inhibitions. So how about yourself? Are you wholly free in your own skin?
Oh no, I doubt it. Or I don't think any of us are. I mean, that's what art is for. It's like a wish, you know. It's a fantasy. It's a enhancement of real life. And so the person I get to be and the way that I get to feel and make people feel for the 2 hours or whatever it is of the show, that's the pinnacle. That's the peak of life and experience for me and some of my audience members. My day-to-day life, man, people would be really bummed out to find out how boring I actually am. You know, I'm sitting here in my library right now and I'm surrounded by all the books that I collect. I'm a big reader. And that's a big part of my offstage life, is I'm a big nerd, you know?
Ain't nothing wrong with that. I mean, you know, we all got to take a dump and get our groceries too. So, yeah. Well, so another thing you've got going on, I don't know how often this is now, but I guess it started during the pandemic, was this Tough Cookies program you were doing. Is that still ongoing?
Well, I've changed the title now because I wanted to signify that the pandemic is over and that period of time is over. So I'm doing it. It's now called the Connie Club.
All right, the Connie Club.
Yes, and June 1st, I start on the radio here in Philadelphia every Saturday with the Connie Club.
Oh, so it's like over-the-air radio?
Correct. I'm going to be on WXPN here in Philadelphia, and we're going to be doing live events with it and eventually a podcast.
All right. What is, because I was going to ask you about upcoming gigs, and some things seem to have something to do with WXPN. What is that? That's a non-commercial station or a commercial station? What is WXPN?
Yes, sir. It's the University of Pennsylvania non-commercial station, but it's a fantastic, really big non-commercial station. And they're an amazing, part of the community here in Philly, the music community.
Yeah.
And they and stations like them around the country and SiriusXM, these stations that play what they want to play, which is rare in this day and age, they are really responsible for my career and so I like operating, you know, in that format where people are music people. They really appreciate the music and the art, and it's not, you know, the terrestrial radio behemoth, corporate behemoth that isn't so much about the music. Right.
Well, so today's Friday the 31st. I saw on your website scheduled to play in Elkton Music Hall, Elkton, Maryland, and this is like a solo thing tonight.
Yeah, I'm doing a solo concert tonight, which I love to do. It's just me and the piano. And you know what? I think I'm going to do a Manfred Mann song tonight. I'm going to do a Manfred Mann song.
I've never heard that. You know, people, you know, Manfred Mann is always, yeah. So you also have a residency. Oh, which Manfred Mann song, by the way?
I think I'm going to do, now that we're talking, I think I'm going to do Pretty Flamingo.
Oh, that's such a Mark Barkin thing. That's a great tune, yeah.
But maybe I'll do some Earth Band. I don't know.
You can keep it straight, Manfred Mann. I mean, Earth Band is great. You know, there you go back to the Bruce Springsteen connection there. But I love all the especially early Manfred Mann stuff, the Paul Jones stuff, and that's all very cool. He's the first lead singer. But now you've also got a residency coming up at the Ardmore Music Hall in June. That's in Ardmore, Pennsylvania.
Yes, which is this right outside of Philly. And that's I'm so excited about this because I'm doing this Philly residency all summer, every month. And it's the band, it's Low Cut Connie, plus special guests, some of which are surprise guests. So people should get
can you tease us with who some of these surprise guests might be?
Well, at one of the shows, my pal Tommy Stinson will be showing up.
Cool.
One of the shows, my friend Betty Levette will be showing up.
My goodness. Betty Levette.
Oh, yeah. Me and Betty.
I have her on my jukebox.
Betty has sung with me 4 or 5 times. She's the best of the best. We've got Marshall Allen from the Sun Ra Orchestra, who's turning 100. Is going to be a one of the shows.
Whoa. Yeah.
We've got some heavy people. We've got some rappers. We've got some comedians. And we have some athletes. And I'll leave it at that.
Wow. Very cool. Well, in a moment, we're going to take a listen to a track off your most recent album, Art Dealers. It's the opening cut, Tell Me Something I Don't Know. I think I got a couple of questions about the track. In there, you talk about being a song and dance man. What is a modern day song and dance man?
I don't know, other than, I guess, just an all-around entertainer, right? Somebody,
yeah.
I don't care what the medium is, your purpose and your stated purpose is to entertain people, make them feel good. You know, like, I saw Iggy Pop years ago on stage. He's a song and dance man. It doesn't have to mean just, like, tap dance Broadway. He's somebody, Iggy Pop is somebody that just gives everything to make people feel good, make people feel alive. That's a song and dance man.
Well, in the song, there seems to be lyrics about having seen it all. Have you seen it all? And what all of it have you seen?
I think at this age and this point.
What
in my
is career, your age, by the way? What does you mean this age? What is your age?
44.
Okay, yeah.
And so I've lived a little bit of life now. This is my 8th Low Cut Connie record release.
Yeah.
And been doing this a while, and it's fun to operate writing, recording, performing now when you know that you know a few things and you've seen a few things.
Yeah.
And know that you're going to, knock on wood, if I stay healthy, I can continue to see things and continue to grow and expand. So I'm enjoying this phase because I see the growth behind me and I see the growth ahead where me and the audience can go together. So
I can't think of what this you mentioned Keith Richards earlier, and this is reminds me of this quote that we're talking about. And this is all paraphrased, but I can't remember which Rolling Stones documentary this is, but there's a scene in there where they're asking, you know, Mick Jagger's like putting on makeup before he goes on stage, and he's pretty young at the time, like in mid-20s, something like this, pretty early on, mid-20s, not in the teens, but in the 20s. And whoever's interviewing, the question is like, could you see yourself doing this at 60? And Jagger, just without batting eyes, oh yeah, of course. And whoever's interviewing is like, really? You know, you had rock and roll at 60? And Jagger's like, well, yeah, you know, why? What a silly question, kind of basically come dismissive of it. Of course, this is what I do, you know?
Yeah.
You mentioned yourself, you know, as long as the gears are holding up and, you know, the bones are working, you're a lifer.
Yeah, I like to think of myself that way. I look at people like Springsteen and Jagger, and I see how they span time. You know, they've like kept the magic trick going for so many decades. And I'm trying to do that. And there's an old, you know, I think it's a play called A Life in the Theater. Life in the Theater is a good life. Like, you dedicate yourself to this lifestyle. Like you've dedicated yourself to the radio. You know, it's like it's a fun way to go through life in music and performing. And I'm in it to win it, you know.
Yeah. Well, Adam, thank you so much for chatting with me today on Our Coolest Conversations.
My man, I really, really enjoyed it. I appreciate it.
We're going to give Tell Me Something I Don't Know a spin now. It's Low Cut Connie off Art Dealers in Little Stevens Underground Garage. Some of Tell Me Something I Don't Know. That's Low Cut Connie here in Little Stevens Underground Garage. That track is off their album from last year titled Art Dealers. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band's Adam Wiener for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Next time around, I'll be joined by my bandmate in the Woggles, Shane Pringle. He's one of our two guitar players, and he and I wrote some songs on our new album, Time Has Come, out now on Wicked Cool Records. That's Shane Pringle on your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.